I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, we're talking about the psychology of partnerships. And joining me in studio this morning is psychiatrist Mark Whaley.
Good morning.
Good morning. Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning.
Hello.
And psychologist Anne Gagan. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here this morning. Partnerships. I feel like that word is thrown around a lot. So let's start out our discussion with just a basic definition of what a partnership is. Who wants to tackle that one?
Without looking it up in the dictionary, I think a simple answer is, let's say two people come together to reach a common goal that they can't reach in and of themselves, generally. And the coming together creates a little group, whatever, that is bigger than each individual and more powerful, more likely to succeed if they do it right. Mm-hmm. And more gratifying in a way that the partners can share their thoughts, bounce off one another. It's not such a lonely thing trying to charge up a hill like in a war or something. Mm-hmm. You have your buddy to watch your back, watch your side. It's an interesting thing about humans. How we do this. Other animals do form partnerships in certain ways. There's the symbiotic interactions between animals. Mm. It's very unique in with Homo sapiens. And I think it's this tendency to cooperate that has given us the society that we have today. We've advanced incredible over the past 10,000 years. Before that, we were hunter-gatherers, and everybody was kind of for themselves. The reason our bodies and our brains really haven't changed in that 10,000 years, but our culture has, mm-hmm. and our culture has evolved in an amazing way. And I think if you drill down onto what's the fuel for this amazing progress, especially in recent years. It's our capacity to cooperate with one another and do things that are greater than what individuals can accomplish, even though we are basically self-interested animals.
Mm-hmm. And competitive, too.
And competitive, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And partnerships, we know there's different kinds. There's business kinds, there's marriages, although I would say maybe not all marriages are partnerships. We can talk about that. Mm-hmm. There's creative kinds of partnerships. As you said, Mark, they can be a recipe for success, growth, evolution, but they're complicated. A lot of different pieces go into those, and they need some clearly defined boundaries and expectations, correct?
Yeah, there's a lot of elements that have to be tended to. Basically, you have to pay attention to the emotions involved, because from the emotions comes behavior, and the behavior can be counter to the purpose of the partnership or very much enhancing of it. So it's really based on the emotions of the individuals and how they play off one another.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you often see in partnerships, whether it's a marital sort of relationship or in business, is that they get into trouble when there are certain expectations of the partnership, of the other person, which are implicit but not explicit. And so it may turn out that people are expecting different things from the partnership, from the other person, than was ever negotiated or outwardly discussed. And in couples therapy and family therapy, you know, these sorts of phenomena, you know, are kind of the meat of figuring out where things have gone wrong.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The expectations you have that, like you said, are under the surface, mm-hmm. and implicit that can destroy partnerships, but also, if you play it right, can enhance.
Right. And I imagine, too, of course, we know this. Partnerships themselves are complex structures that they're going to evolve over time, just like the people inside them. And so you bring in a set of implicit boundaries or expectations, but then those may change over time, too. So what may have been acceptable at one time to you may suddenly not be. And being able to kind of highlight that, identify that, and then talk about it is going to be really important.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think that it's important to think about a lot of young people enter into a marital partnership or a relational partnership without having those discussions about what are our mutual goals here.
That's right.
And it doesn't have to be in terms of, well, we're going to set up a goal to do this and do that.
Yeah.
But they do carry expectations oftentimes in, well, we'll get a house together, then we'll have children. And without really looking at each other and saying, who are we?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do we bring to each other?
Right.
What can we work with here?
That's right.
And setting goals based on the two individuals and their strengths and weaknesses.
Exactly.
So those discussions are really important before you make a lifelong commitment.
That's right.
Right.
And one of the things that couples therapists commonly do in the beginning of couples therapy is ask how the couple met each other. And what was it that made this person stand out against the background of others? And what was the magical sort of interest? Everybody talks about it in terms of a rush, a high, love at first sight, you know, those kind of things. But if you drill down and try to find out what was the key that opened the door, that is the key to these expectations that we're talking about that frequently have to do with the person's own baggage and what they want to fix about themselves they bring to the marriage or to the relationship. And then that gets played out over years. And unfortunately, marriages can people can really suffer in marriages because their basic expectations are not met and not spoken. That is agony. Sometimes it just has to come to divorce. That's the... I've always thought of it as the goal of couples therapy is to uncover these biases and expectations and what the root of them are, too, because so often it has to do with the person's own models of relationships that they've seen in their parents or experienced in their parents over years and also between them and their parents.
If you depend just on that spark.
Yep.
That usually fades.
Exactly.
Except that in reading about creative partnerships and really dynamic business partnerships, you have to have the spark to begin with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have to feel that chemistry. You have to feel like there's something here.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to build trust.
Yep.
And it seems like all the same principles for a marital relationship and a creative partnership and a business partnership, time and trust and conversation and sorting through, really, you have to build the trust to be able to set the goals and the mission and move forward.
Right.
Now, alternatively, we have, you know, on our planet cultures in which such a thing as this sort of spark would be really unheard of. So, for example, you know, in Hindu culture, marriages are arranged.
Mm-hmm.
Often, as I understand it, the bride and groom may not have met each other prior to the wedding date, or if they have, they certainly don't know each other. Interestingly, the marriages which result from these arranged negotiations between the families are more enduring than the so-called love marriages that we have here in the West. And I lived in a village in Nepal for 6 months, and kids would approach me and my friend who was there in the Peace Corps, and they would beg us to bring them to America, not only because, of course, everybody in America is rich, but also because if they came here, they could have a love marriage instead of an arranged marriage.
Sure.
But
that sounds romantic.
but the evidence is pretty clear that arranged marriages, which are based on socioeconomic similarities of values and other phenomena which are actually associated with more enduring partnerships are a better predictor of a successful marriage than what we have. And of course, in everything you say, Anne, is true about, you know, that spark being there, about having conversations. But, you know, in general, as people, we're not really all that good at having these conversations.
We
usually have them in the couple's therapist's office or in the attorney's office or in the divorce mediator's office where you really don't have much choice.
Why do you think that is?
Why do I think it is that we're not very good at it?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
It's a good question.
It's hard. To keep
we could be in business?
I don't, yeah.
Yeah. It takes effort and it's hard and it's uncomfortable, I would imagine. I mean, you know, I'm married and we've had tough conversations and that sometimes it's a little ugly, but if you're in a partnership and your expectations are similar, then you can, and you have trust, then you can say, all right, this is ugly, but it's because we're trying to reach the same place together. So, but we have to go through this kind of swamp of whatever this uncomfortable conversation is. And sometimes it's easier to just say, I'll do it later.
About driver's ed. You know, before we get our license, we go to driver's ed, we sit in a classroom, we're given a book, an operating manual, so to speak, and we have to learn the skills of what it means to drive before somebody allows us to get in behind the wheel and practice in a car in a parking lot. But, you know, you don't need to do that to have kids or get married.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, maybe we should really have a marriage ed. Now, I know in the Catholic Church they do have
pre-cana.
Right. But and I don't know really how helpful that all is. But they leave out the
laboratory part of it, is living together. Maybe, you know, the modern, everybody kind of lives together nowadays. It's so often before a marriage. For a while, it is a laboratory that you can see what comes out. You know, the other thing about that, the spark and the love marriage, that has a physiological component, a hormonal component, and that doesn't last. You know, maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's a year, who knows? You know, that total enthralling experience that you have when a relationship that really feels right for you gets started. It peters out after a while, and the same thing with affairs. When people have affairs, it's incredibly intense. It's like a drug fix, certainly in the beginning, usually it wears off. Not always, but usually it does, and it has to do with not facing the expectations that you bring. And the what you're looking for, which is frequently nirvana, and that doesn't happen in life very often, or in any lasting way, anyway.
Right, the rose-colored glasses, living on cloud nine rather than kind of looking at the reality of the situation.
That's right.
Catherine, you were mentioning about it gets ugly or difficult or dark. There's a book called The Power of Two, How Relationships Drive Creativity by Joshua Shank. He said that's part of it. You have to have that. I mean, that's the reality. You have two in a creative partnership, and marriage is a creative partnership. You have two strong individuals with all their stuff.
Yeah.
And the goal is to be able to lay that out, put the greater good of the other and the family before your own personal needs, and back and forth. Different times people take different roles and have power. The power is never actually equal. It's always going to go back and forth. But to be able to face that unpleasantness with the foundation of trust, with the idea that we're going to talk about this, it's not the end of the world, we are going to move towards that greater good. And I think those are the building blocks of a really solid relationship.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Any kind of relationship. Because if you're not addressing that stuff, it's just always underneath the surface. And it's going to, I would imagine, over time warp the partnerships on this trajectory. But it's going to sidetrack the partnership over time if you're not going to go through these kind of initial conversations. Or I would say evolving conversations, because we're always growing and changing. I want to say out to you listeners, have you been in a partnership that that didn't turn out the way you planned, or have you been a part of a partnership that helped you be more successful than you thought? We want to hear from you, your thoughts on partnerships, the good, the bad, the ugly, the evolving. So give us a call, 866-999-4626, or you can send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We are talking partnerships. We have to go to a break, but we will be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Point. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. We're talking about the psychology of partnerships today. And with me in studio is psychologist Ann Gagan, along with psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz and Mark Whaley. Before we went to the break, we were talking about kind of having the need for good communication and the need for kind of sometimes going through some uncomfortable times with your partner so that you can be clear on expectations from the start, but then throughout the partnership. Would you say a culture or a set of norms is typical in a successful partnership?
Yeah, sure. One thing, just before we jump to that, sure. Anne asked that very good question that shut us up for a moment. It was such a good question. You know, why we aren't good at discussing these things.
Yeah.
And I think what comes to my mind is what we're really driven by so much is shame. That if we open up about what is really troubling us in our hearts and our guts, we'll be shamed about it. Or we are ashamed to do it. It means that we're less than, we're not, we're helpless, defective, no good.
And
weak, exactly. Acknowledging that out in the open is toxic, at least in terms of our way of looking at it. And it's that circular reasoning that keeps us quiet and keeps us poor. At communicating and being open. So just to put that aspect in, I think makes sense for us to and everybody's subject to it. You know, so you're not bad because you feel shamed or feel ashamed. It's a human it goes with human survival, really. So
it makes me think of fear, too. Like, yeah. We may have shame, but then there's the fear in letting it out when right. Sometimes just confronting that little demon actually kind of neutralizes it, and it's
Absolutely.
Not so bad after all. But the fear can be that big obstacle to confronting those feelings of being right. less than.
Exactly.
It's always very striking to me when I hear somebody, and often it's on the radio, but sometimes it's in real life or even in my office, when you hear somebody speaking about what they need or what they feel, and doing it and expressing themselves in a way that is completely non-defensive, non-judgmental, but just really kind of almost in a calm, relaxed, mm-hmm. Calm way. That's the kind of way that you would hope that all of us would be able to talk with our business partners, our spouses, or really anybody that we have to
right.
negotiate life with.
That's right. Instead, we turn out like some of the talking heads on CNN that just yell at each other and talk over each other, talk through each other.
Well, a lot of modeling is, as someone mentioned earlier, that since we're not teaching people in school or, you know, even as adults, taking part in like being reflective on how we do these types of things and be conscientious. So we rely on our childhood. We rely on those mm-hmm. role models that whether or not we liked them, right, or whether or not they were showing us a good example of a partnership or a relationship, they end up kind of even subconsciously driving how we approach the relationships in our own lives as adults, and then mirroring them down to the next generation that's coming up behind us. It can be a little bit self-perpetuating. I have Stephen on the phone from Chatham. Stephen, thanks for giving us a call.
Thanks, Katie. Yeah, this is Steve Buckley from Chatham, and you were talking, one of your guests was talking earlier about the beginning of a relationship in a pre-marriage where there's a bloom, I guess a physical bloom, but then the hard work of listening and setting expectations for the relationship start to take root and so forth. And I remember before I got married almost 40 years ago, the minister was counseling us and said there were three things to a successful relationship, and he said they were communication and communication. And so I thought, oh yeah, I took communication in college and so forth and so on, so yeah, I know I got a communication is good, you know, stuff. But now as the years go on, that message is more and more profound to me. Because that is the key, and of course, the key to communication, two-way, because that's what co means, is two-way communication, which is actually being redundant, because there's no such thing as one-way communication.
Right.
Listening is the key, and that's hard. It's harder to listen than it is to speak, and so I think that's where a lot of our rough patches in my our marriage was when one of us wasn't listening. And the expectations in a relationship like that is that we expect that the person who we have the relationship with is going to be our best listener, perhaps, hopefully, in the world. And when we feel we're not being listened to, that's the part where we feel let down, and the trust that we thought this person was going to be listening to us. And it doesn't happen all the time, of course, but those times when we feel like we're being ignored or disrespected or not being listened to tend to be the root of why didn't you buy the right thing at the grocery store? You know, I told you three times, and you didn't listen to me. And then the argument becomes, and if you didn't listen to me, it's because you don't love me.
Or you don't care.
So that's the nub of it. So I just wanted to pass that on. But the listening part is so hard. And I just say, there was a clip right before the show about people talking about the Woods Hole Ferry terminal design.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard it?
Yes.
Where somebody spoke, and basically the lady there was speaking at the meeting saying it. I'm paraphrasing. She said, "You're not listening to us."
Right.
Right. Yeah.
They cut off the conversation.
Yes.
The board did.
Thank you.
Stephen, thank you so much for your insightful comment. We appreciate it.
I was trying to imagine how anybody could remember something that was said to them 40 years ago, especially three things. But then it became clear because it was all the same thing.
Yeah, and as we've been talking about, much easier said than done, or not said than done sometimes, right?
Sure.
You know, if somebody's listening who's in a partnership, they're having some troubles right now, do you have some, you know, and you mentioned, Jonathan, earlier that often these types of conversations don't happen until it's really dire and you're in the couple's therapy room or you're talking to your lawyer and you're considering breaking apart, right? Things are bad. Mm. So what kinds of techniques would you have for people who don't want to get that far, but they might be a little bit wayward from that initial spark and that initial kind of joining together?
Well, if they have a kind of an academic bent, or they want to look into what people have used over, what professionals have used over the years, I would suggest that they look up or Google Harville Hendrix, H-E-N-D-R-I-X, and specifically what he calls intentional dialogue exercise. And you can do this without following the steps of it. But basically what it means is if you're in a conflict with your partner, you sort of stop the conflict and you agree that one is going to be silent and one is going to say what their problem is. And the other one's just going to listen. And not only listen, after the person finishes their paragraph of complaints, say, the other person says it back as if it's theirs. They're pretending. They don't agree with the things that have been said, but they're saying it back and asking at the end of their recital of what they heard, did I get it? Is there anything else? What have I missed here? Then the sender completes it. You kind of go back and forth with this until the sender can agree that the receiver has gotten it. The next step would be the receiver tries to speak it all himself from the other person's point of view. This is the empathic part where you put yourself in the person's shoes, regardless of whether you agree with it or not. There's some other parts of it, but then you just reverse roles and you communicate this way, one at a time, the listener actually repeating back like they're in school or something to see if they really paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
The sender is judging whether they really paid attention. Do that, exercise like that, and you have to agree to the ground rules in the beginning, and you're not going to interrupt each other, and you're going to have trouble not interrupting. But if you really can kind of follow that outline, you can get somewhere because it encourages the openness. It encourages the honesty. It encourages non-judgmental listening and support. And it encourages, most importantly, it encourages safety. The ground rules make it that you're going to be safe in this communication, as long as you agree to them and follow them, you at least can have confidence that you're safe in discussing this and not going to be jumped on because of what you've said, whether it's accurate or not. That's so much what people conflict over, whether it's accurate or not, and they miss what was really bothering them. It's a lot of talk, and they don't get to what's really bothering. But at any rate, intentional dialogue exercise is kind of the term for it, and you can read about it. But it's pretty simple.
Well, I like the ground rules, and I think that that's should be established early on in any relationship, mm-hmm. that you don't discredit the other person or blame the other person or stonewall them. Usually right. these issues are like, yeah, you forgot the tomato sauce, but they become, they become something else.
That's right.
And it's often good to go back to what was not done, but not with that blame and demeaning, because that's what erodes any relationship,
right.
is the demeaning and discarding and assuming motivation, assuming
that's
things.
Right. That's right.
And that's what deteriorates any
Yeah, our brains do that.
Yeah.
We always assume patterns, whether they're there or not.
Right.
And we emotionally react to those patterns, regardless of what the real situation is.
I was going to say, in listening to you talking about having to sit there and say back until you get it right what your partner is saying, can allow you to let your emotions kind of calm down, right? I mean, so much of this, you're like, wah, and you did this, and then you did this, and it escalates, and you're just blinded by that emotion, and that kind of ends up driving your conversation if you're forced to sit there and you want to get through the pain of having to repeat it back to your partner, especially when you don't agree.
Right.
Then you're going to have to concentrate on what that person's saying. And I would imagine your emotions are then going to kind of calm down. You maybe will get a little more rational so that perhaps then it won't seem so bad.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Here's a little trick that I often recommend to people that I think can be really helpful, and it's so simple. So if you want to talk about something with a partner, and it could be business, but typically it would be more in a marriage or in a romantic relationship, but you're really apprehensive about bringing up whatever it is or saying whatever it is or asking whatever question because you expect that this other person, your partner, is going to react poorly, you begin by saying, you know, there's something that I've really been wanting to talk to you about, but I keep hesitating because I think, you know, I'm afraid that you might find it upsetting, and I really don't want you to be upset. Mm-hmm. When you start a conversation by saying that, number one, it makes it really more difficult for the person to be upset because they know that you're on pins and needles. You're feeling really kind of like you're not coming at them in a bullying, aggressive way.
Yes.
You're coming at them in a more humble, sort of passive way, and you're not really trying to upset them. In fact, it's been hard for you. You know, so it kind of sets the stage in a way that I think makes it. It's disarming for the person, really. I guess that's the term
yeah.
I would use. And
disarming,
yeah.
Take the arms out of it.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that gets you at least the first few minutes of the conversation before things blow up.
Right.
But some of what Mark was talking about, just to add to that, are tools that you know any of us can use in a relationship, which are the very everyday tools in the couples therapist's office. Which you know, one of the reasons why people are able to accomplish in couples therapy what they haven't been able to accomplish sitting, you know, over the kitchen table, is that people tend to engage in mutual blaming,
mm-hmm.
which they're instructed by the couples therapist. No, that's not going to be helpful. Let's not be pointing fingers. That's not going to get us anywhere. People are instructed by the couples therapist just to do you hear what the person is saying? Not do you agree with it or disagree with it, but just do you understand what they're feeling. So, I mean, there's things, of course, this is not rocket science. We can teach each other or ourselves to do this,
mm-hmm.
and save the aggravation and expense of going to see a couples therapist. But it really is, those are essential ingredients to having a productive communication.
Exactly. Yeah.
866-999-4626. Do you have a partnership that has helped you grow and become the person that you had hoped to be, or are you struggling in a partnership and you could use some tips? Give us a call, 866-999-4626, or send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Listening to this, kind of acknowledging your partner and listening to them and stopping the blame, it strikes me that you, when you enter a partnership, it's also helpful to kind of really know yourself, too. Know your strengths and weaknesses. Know maybe your hot button, like what's going to make you go. And because you have to be able to put those things aside a little bit. There's some humility involved if you really want to get through a sticky patch in your relationship and keep respect and trust intact.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's a self-restraint is definitely part of it. And self-knowledge and basically, we always talk about mindfulness, which is a goal and can make things run much, much smoother. And you were talking earlier about creative partnerships,
yes.
You know, the singers, the music makers, whatever, or the entertainers that really get together and they make music together.
Yeah,
what is unique about those?
Well,
those,
you know, the one it's from that book by Schenck. He looked at all kinds of creative partnerships. The most telling was John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And it's a really interesting thing. They met very young, very opposite backgrounds, actually very, very different personalities. Paul was apparently very neat and orderly and very methodical in his writing and his skills, whereas John, who came from a much more disruptive childhood situation, was writing notes about songs on little pieces of paper. But what happened to the two of them was exactly what Catherine just said. They were comfortable and aware of their own talents, but they appreciated each other's ability to spark their creativity beyond their own limits. And apparently Paul was more sensitive to criticism, which I found interesting, whereas John was like, yeah, tell me about it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk it through. And their creativity was so dynamic, and it's tarnished over time. You know, they think one of the fellows, Paul's more of a genius or John's more of a genius. It was really their dynamic partnership, which Schenck calls the, you know, creative intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they fought and they went, all kinds of things happened. But what they did do was keep going back and keep stretching each other and keep challenging each other and keep putting the goal of their music beyond the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's with any creative partnership. What is beyond us?
Yeah.
Where are we going? What do we want to do here?
Mm-hmm.
What is outside of us that we together can reach where we can't reach by ourselves?
That's right.
866-999-4626, or send us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We are talking about partnerships and all their different shapes and forms, from creative to marital to business. If you have a comment or some insight or tip, let us know. We have to go to a break, but we'll be back in just a moment. And you are listening to The Point. I'm Catherine Iden, in for Mindy Todd today, and we are talking about the psychology of partnerships. And in studio this morning are psychiatrists Mark Whaley and Jonathan Swartz, along with psychologist Anne Gagan. And before the break, we were talking about creative partnerships, and we were talking about John Lennon and Paul McCartney. And something that struck me in listening in to what you were talking about with creative partnerships and how they help people kind of reach beyond their capacity is that creative partnerships in marriages, although marriages are formalized and institutionalized, partnerships like that maybe aren't always, they don't have a formal start. That kind of partnership may not have a formal start, which may lead to bumps down the line, versus, say, something like a business partnership, which we haven't talked a lot about this morning, where, I mean, that's more clinical. You're sitting down with someone saying, all right, mutual interest here, you know, vision for the future. We're going to set clear boundaries and expectations. Of course, we know some of the same elements go into a business partnership and some of the same pitfalls as well. But I just, you know, thinking about, you know, Lennon and McCartney were kind of, as I, musically married to each other, and we saw it very publicly. Their their ups and then their very dramatic downs.
Yeah, I think any when you put two creative people together, the passions that come out of that are extraordinary. The other partnership that I looked into was Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, and that started out as he was much older than she was, but she was fascinated by his art, and for many, many years she just supported him until. Even though she had this innate creativity and brilliance and genius, and she wanted to be the quieter partner until she had a trauma of a miscarriage, and it happened in Detroit, and she painted that experience. And with the miscarriage came this burst of genius and creativity. And he supported it. I think this was a romantic and creative partnership. Both of them were incredibly supportive of their own artistic genius and thought the other was brilliant. But their personality, the personality issues started getting in the way, the jealousies and the because of the romantic part. And so talk about complex and complicated. But I listened to there's a podcast also called 1+1 that I think is really good about these kind of relationships. And I listened to two composers, male and female, who also happen to be married. They just complimented each other right and left. They just said, I'm always with the most intelligent person in the world. They always soothed and promoted the genius of the other in that creative part of their relationship. Mm-hmm. If you don't do that, and you get into competition,
right,
then it starts falling apart.
Yeah, you have to put aside your self-interest and keep a rein on it while you look at the bigger picture of what you both would like to accomplish. That neither can accomplish alone generally.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting when partnerships kind of cross that border, per se, and we were just talking about married couples who also are partners, like artistically or maybe in business. And, you must need to have then kind of maybe two there. It's one couple, but maybe two partnerships. I mean, can you have one big partnership that encompasses your marriage and your, let's say, your business venture?
Sure. Family businesses is a fertile ground for partnerships that can really flourish, but really go awry and are very risky. And generally people say don't get in business with your family and friends because of that. Psychiatrists, psychologists do consult with family businesses a lot to try to iron out the family inner conflicts, basic conflicts, from keep them at bay while you're trying to work together for the business benefit. And it's very, very sticky, very messy.
I've been consulting to family-owned businesses for about 30 years. It's not something that I spend most of my time doing, but I've always had an interest in it and had a stream of entrepreneurs, come to the office, try to work out some problems. And as you're talking just now, Mark, I was thinking about how often all of us, whether we're mental health professionals or not, we see that many, many people function at a very different level in the workplace than they do in their private life. We see people who function really well in the workplace and achieve and get promoted and are rising stars, and somehow when they take off their business suit or whatever it is and go home, they really function at a very primitive, unsuccessful level. There's so many, countless examples of that. So when you're in business with a family member, you're immediately confronted with that dichotomy between how people are in the workplace thinking for the sake of business and how they are on that much more personal level.
Sure.
Now, I say that I'm now currently in business with my wife.
Tell us about that.
I was going to say, how's that going?
Yeah, right. Well, she helps me out with the TMS practice that we have, and she's been, incredible asset. But a lot of times, I really don't want to hear about it. When we're home, I'm home at the end of the long day, and she's eager. Anyway, that's not really what this is about. But
the need for boundaries.
Right. But the expectations and needs and dynamics and goals and implicit and explicit assumptions that exist in the workplace could be very different than those outside of the workplace. So when you're in business with a family member or a friend, you know, you better have your eyes wide open.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yes. Yeah, and in family dynamics too, I think about when you think about the person who's a superstar at work and then comes home and kind of unravels, you know, that the family dynamic you kind of hope is it's unconditional. No matter how bad I am, you're going to take me back. Versus in a business setting, you know, yeah, we have a partnership, we have a thing going, but if I abuse you too much, you know, you have reason and you have the ability to walk out and destroy everything you've sure. built. I guess. I mean, you can in family too, but
well, one of the principles of a successful partnership is the partner should not allow the person to be his own enemy without telling him, he should protect him from himself, so to speak. I wish that Donald Trump had something like that. Because he is definitely so much dominating our news and is his own enemy, and he can't help it. But if you're going to have a partnership with, he's an extreme example, but you want to, and you see somebody going down a path that's going to be destructive to them and to the partnership. You don't want to keep quiet because you're afraid of hurting their feelings. You have to have that openness, safety in communication again. Those three C's.
In everything, you know, it's the phrase, I've got your back.
That's right.
And that doesn't always mean I'm always supportive. That means right. I'm going to tell you honestly. And that's the agreement. And that's in business, you know, these amazing creative business partnerships and obviously in a relationship. And when I would do support groups with widows and widowers, that's the phrase that comes up. It's mm-hmm. like, nobody's got my back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's almost physical when you think about mm-hmm. it. There's almost a physical sure. sensation of not being safe.
Sure.
It's quite literal in this era of much higher frequency of skin cancer. I mean, and I mean this in the most concrete sense.
Yes.
If there's nobody there to look at your back, you could have a significant lesion that doesn't get seen until
that's
there's
right.
a big, big problem.
That's right.
So that's how concrete I can be.
It is concrete. But that's true.
I've been listening to a book about D-Day, and it really tells the intimate details of the soldiers' experience, both on the German side, some, and the Allied side. It's amazing what people will do when they have somebody at their side to do it with. And otherwise, it makes absolutely no sense that anybody, once that landing craft door went down, anybody should step out. Mm. But they all did. Mm.
Psychological fortress, really, around these people.
Absolutely. And they saw the guy next to him take a bullet and the water filled with blood. And they see that, but they still go on. They still go on for their purpose. And God thank them for what they did. It was impossible. That tendency to basically, from an individual standpoint, they did the irrational thing, stepping off that boat or, you know, putting down the gate and going out there and facing the machine gun fire that was coming in their face. That was irrational, but they did it for the greater gain later on. They all signed on to the greater gain for a number of different individual reasons. That was an extreme example, certainly, of hundreds of thousands of partners operating together to accomplish something they agreed was horribly evil and needed to be eliminated. It reminds me that there's a, if people are interested in game theory or want to look at some into that, why we do cooperate and why we do, or when it's even better for us not to cooperate. Individually, it's better for those people not to get off that boat. We do have that tendency that's in our genes, really, as a bias toward cooperation with each other, like I mentioned earlier about the progress of our society is based on that orientation to cooperate, even though in our own interest it's not good. You can look up something called the Prisoner's Dilemma, which is an example. It's a game that is played, and it shows, it tests how whether individuals, if they don't know what the other partner is going to do, whether they make a decision to cooperate or not cooperate, and what the consequences are of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the this game has been played, where, you know, sorted out statistically millions of times, thousands of times. And what comes is a irrational computer when they play the game, or I'm sorry, a rational computer when they play the game, the computer will, depending on the rewards and the punishments, they will do the rational thing for themselves. They're programmed that way. But humans don't. They have bias towards cooperating. As I said before, I think this is in our genes, because think of a hunter-gatherer. And our brains were formed when humans were hunter-gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, and then we just inherited that. But it hasn't changed much in 10,000 years or 12,000 years. But it made a lot of sense for a hunter, if he would had a good day and got a kill, to share his food with the guy who didn't. Because then that guy is going to survive. Why? And why is that good? Well, the next day, he might be the lucky one, and he'll share with me. So we both survive. And you can see how powerful that is when you think of survival of the fittest. We're fit when we cooperate, we survive. So that's why I think we have that that bias.
Yeah. Andy, you looked like you wanted to say something.
No, I'm really listening to that, because I think sometimes relationships get back to that level. What do we have to do to survive here?
Yeah,
exactly.
And we have to cooperate.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting, too, that, you know, you're making the case that it's really, really embedded in us, that even when we're presented with an opportunity that might help us to get the better outcome, like we're in prison, we're going to go free if we rat on our partner. But we're inclined not to do that, and we'll suffer from it. But then the elements, you know, of actually maintaining a partnership really need to be kind of learned in a lot of ways. I mean, we have these lists in front of us from all of our research we did for all of us here for this show the list of the 10, you know, reasons of ways in which to have a successful partnership. Some of them are intuitive, as we talked about with communication. We know communicate, but doing it can be a lot harder. So you've got these two kind of pieces, I think, to the partnership angle here. It's a very sophisticated kind of concept when you want to dig into it.
Sure. Yeah, and it plays out internationally. You know, we just, 20 years ago, we just finished a Cold War. And that's an example of, do you cooperate for the good of everybody, or do you keep escalating, protecting yourself, building, you know, putting all sorts of resources into arms, as opposed to what else we could put resources into. And that played out, and it ended finally when the Soviets didn't have an economy that could support it anymore, so they broke up. But we're also facing it today with climate change. Do we cooperate to save our planet, or do we live in the present and for our gain right now and not give up on gas and oil and the biofuels? We have to sacrifice.
So it's interesting how the inclination to cooperate is forever pitted against the inclination to compete.
Exactly.
And so throughout history, and in the Cold War is a great example of this.
We are running out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, and you know, the Cold War is an excellent example of this, and there's so much reading you can do online. Thank you so much to my guests this morning, psychologist Ann Gagan and psychiatrist Mark Whaley and Jonathan Schwartz, for coming together to talk about partnerships, the intricacies, how they're embedded in our genes, and how we can make them successful. I'm Catherine Ident, in for Mindy Todd. Thank you for joining us for The Point this morning.